to face us and stretches her hand out to me. I'm Rosie. Nice to meet you. She looks back at Diana. I heard about Tom, Diana. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
What can I do for you today? I look at Diana, who looks at me. Finally, she sighs.
Well, I haven't been feeling myself since Tom died, which I imagine is to be expected, but Lucy wanted me to come and see you.
Dr. Paisley's eyes touch mine for a second. You're right, no one feels themselves for a while after losing a partner, sometimes a long while, but we need to be keeping an eye on your health through this period, so Lucy was right to bring you in.
Diana shrugs. Good then.
How has your sleep been?
Broken.
Have you been doing things you normally do? Catching up with friends, seeing your grandchildren?
I had drinks with the girls at the baths last week.
And how was that?
Diana looks out the window. It was all right, I suppose.
As we chat, Rosie wraps a blood pressure strap around Diana's arm and the machine starts pumping it up. Diana barely notices. Has your mood been low in general? Dr. Paisley asks her.
You could say that.
Any issues with memory?
I don't remember,
Diana says, deadpan, and I chuckle. Rosie asks a few more questions, nodding at each answer as though it makes perfect sense. Well, she says finally, I think it might be a good idea to do some blood tests.
Diana raises an eyebrow. Blood tests for what?
Several things. Anemia, thyroid, plus the usual standard things.
She types into her computer and a blue referral paper spits out of her printer.
But from what you've said, Diana, there's no question in my mind that you're suffering from depression. And so I have to ask, have you had any thoughts about suicide?
Diana doesn't answer. After a moment, Dr. Paisley's eyes move to me.
Would you prefer if we talked without your daughter in the room, Diana? Sometimes it's easier to be frank if...
I don't need to speak privately, Diana says. No, I haven't thought about suicide.
Good. Good.
Dr. Paisley prints out a referral to a good psychologist and prescribes some antidepressant medication, and we make an appointment to come back in a week. It's not until we get out of there that it occurs to me that the doctor called me Diana's daughter, and Diana didn't correct her.
Chapter 46. Lucy. The present.
Ollie, I say as the landline starts ringing.
The day your mother died, were you at her house?
He sits forward, resting his hands on his knees, and takes a deep breath. I was.
Why?
I say, a moment before the more important question comes.
And why didn't you tell me?
I wanted to.
Then why didn't you?
The phone keeps ringing. A loud, shrill interruption. I want to pull the damn thing out of the wall. I'll just answer it, Ollie says, walking over to the phone.
Ollie, no, just leave.
But he's already snatching up the receiver. Hello? I swear under my breath. It's Ollie. He's quiet for a moment, then his eyes find mine. Yes, just a minute. He holds the phone out to me. It's Jones.
For me?
I feel a pinch of worry as I take the phone.
Lucy speaking.
Lucy, it's Detective Jones. Ahmed and I need to speak to you as a matter of urgency.
Jones's voice sounds clipped.
Do you think you could come down to the station?
What for?
I say.
I want to say that I've had enough of the police calling at ridiculous hours of the night, hauling Ollie or me down to the station. I want to tell Jones that we have little children who are asleep, and that unless I'm under arrest, she'll have to wait until the morning. But I don't say any of this, because I have a feeling my ability to be outraged may just have been compromised. We want to talk to you about an organisation called VEI. It stands for Voluntary Euthanasia International. We've received information that indicates your mother-in-law was a member of this organisation, and we have reason to believe that you have knowledge of this. I tell her I'll be there as soon as I can. Chapter 47. Lucy. The Past. When I arrive home after Diana's doctor's appointment, Patrick and Nettie are pulling up out front. "Hi," I say, emerging from the car. "This is a surprise." "We called Ollie," Nettie says. "He said we could come on over." "Oh, well, good. Actually, I'm glad you're here." "Us too," Nettie says, oddly chipper. Patrick, to the contrary, seems a little down. He takes his time locking up the car, then slopes up the path a few paces behind us. "How has your day been?" Nettie asks. I let them in with my key. "Actually, it's been a little strange, which is why I'm glad you're here. I need to talk to you about Diana." We walk into the kitchen and living area, where Ollie is standing at the fridge cracking a beer.
"Good day, everyone," he says. "Beer, Patrick?"
"Mum," Nettie says to me.
"What about Mum?" "Yes, what about Mum?" Ollie says.
The kids, in front of the TV in their PJs, look up, then quickly down again. "Have they been fed?" I ask Ollie.
"Chicken nuggets, peas and corn," he says proudly. "Wine for you, ladies?"
"Sure," I say.
"I'm fine," Nettie says.
Ollie holds out a beer to Patrick, which he accepts and opens in record time. I wonder if everything is okay with him, but I'm too preoccupied with Diana to spend too much time thinking about it. "Why don't we go into the dining room to get away from little ears?" I suggest, "and I'll tell you what's going on with Diana." As I clear the clutter from the dining room table, I notice Nettie giving Patrick a look, somewhere between a smile and a wince. I feel a little dance inside. She's pregnant, I realize. She must be pregnant.
"So, do you guys have anything to tell us?" I ask when we're all sitting.
Nettie's smile indicates that she does, but she shakes her head.
No, you first. Tell us about Mum."
"Okay," I say. "Actually, I dropped in to visit her today."
There's a short, loaded silence. Even Patrick stares at me like I have two heads.
"You dropped in to visit Mum?" Ollie says.
Admittedly, it is not the kind of thing I usually do. Still, I'm taken aback by everyone's level of shock.
"Well, we've hardly seen her since Tom died. We've barely even heard from her. I was worried. As it turns out, I was right to be. She looks like she's been sleeping in her clothes, not eating properly. I took her to the doctor just to get her looked at."
Ollie puts down his beer.
"What did the doctor say?"
"She's had some blood tests, but she's most likely depressed. She was given a prescription for antidepressants. The doctor also recommended exercise and keeping some sort of routine. And I thought we could all take turns taking her out, bringing her food, that kind of thing."
"Good idea," Ollie says.
"Sure," Nettie says. "Yes, why not?"
But Nettie seems distracted, jittery. Her eyes bounce around the room the way the kids' eyes do when they arrive at someone's house for a playdate and they can't decide which toy to play with first. It's distracting.
"Is everything all right, Nettie?"
"Well, actually, Patrick and I do have something we'd like to discuss with you."
She beams at Patrick, who smiles back a little less enthusiastically.
"You're pregnant," Ollie exclaims.
Nettie's beam dims a little.
"Well, no, not yet. but that is what we wanted to discuss with you. The thing is, my fertility issues are multi-level. It's not just the polycystic ovaries, it's also my ovum and my uterus. Give me a fertility problem and I have it. Her laugh is a thin, empty titter. Our doctor told us this week that our best chance we have for conceiving a child is using a donor egg and a surrogate. I take a sip of my wine, drop my gaze. It's not how we imagined becoming parents, obviously. The baby wouldn't be biologically related to me, but it would be related to Patrick and it would have been conceived to be ours. I think this is our best chance at having a baby.
Wow, Ollie says. His expression says he doesn't know if this is good news or not. I, on the other hand, am fairly certain it is not.
So you guys are going to do it? Use an egg donor and surrogate?
Well, that's where it gets complicated.
Nettie winces slightly.
We'd like to, but egg donation and surrogacy is only allowed in Australia for altruistic reasons, so we can't pay anyone. Someone would have to volunteer to do it.
Can't you go overseas?
Ollie interrupts.
I saw a documentary about people going to India to do this or the United States.
That's an option, Nettie says. But it would be very expensive. More importantly, the baby would be so far away from us while it was in utero. We wouldn't be able to go to any scans or check on the mother's health, maybe not even be there for the birth if the mother goes into labour early. Also, we don't understand the health system over there. How do we know their systems are reliable?
Patrick still hasn't said a word. Admittedly, it would be hard to when Nettie is saying so many words.
So what are you going to do?
Ollie asks. Ollie still has no idea. He must be the only one. I take another very large sip of my wine and force myself to swallow.
She wants me to do it, I say.
Nettie looks at me. She's cautiously excited but trying to keep it under wraps. She takes a clear plastic bag out of her handbag and places it on the table between us.
I have some information here, she says.
I see the words "becoming a surrogate" printed on the front of a purple brochure next to a picture of a headless pregnant body.
It's actually a pretty straightforward process.
Ollie looks at Nettie, blinking wildly, a deer in the headlights.
You want Lucy to donate an egg? To be your surrogate?
Nettie keeps her gaze on me.
I know I have no right to ask.
You have the right to ask, I say, but... Nettie sits forward in her chair, her hands folded on the table in almost a businesslike fashion. I get the feeling she is prepped and ready to refute any argument I might have. I feel sweat bloom under my arms.
Wait, Ollie says. You do want Lucy to donate an egg and carry the baby? So it would be Lucy's child and Patrick's?
No,
Nettie says. Her nervous energy seems to have abated now, and she is oddly calm.
It would be mine and Patrick's.
But...
Ollie is stuck on this point, and for once I agree with him.
Biologically, it would be Lucy's.
Yes, Nettie admits, looking at me. I don't want to put you on the spot, Lucy, but can you tell me what you think about this idea?
I push back in my chair, blinking slowly.
I mean, it's a little out of the blue, Nettie. Obviously, I'd need to think about it.
Of course, Nettie says, nodding. Of course you do, but maybe you could share your initial reaction?
She says she needs to think about it, Patrick says, uncharacteristically gruff. Give the woman a break.
In contrast to Nettie's businesslike body language, Patrick is almost sullen-looking. He sits back in his chair. His arms are crossed and his chin is lowered, almost to his chest.
Nettie, my initial reaction is shock, I tell her. There's a lot to think about. Ollie and I would have to talk about it.
So it is a possibility. It is something you would consider.
Nettie squeezes her eyes closed and pumps her fists as if making a wish.
Honestly, I say, I don't think it is.
Nettie's eyes open, but her gaze remains lowered.
I'm sorry, I've thought about this before in a philosophical way, and I just couldn't do it. After all, it would be my child.
Half your child, Nettie corrects weakly.
There's no such thing as half children. It would be mine as much as Archie and Harriet and Edie are mine. I'm sorry, but I couldn't conceive a child, carry it to term, and then give it away. I just couldn't, even for you.
You won't even think about it for a few days? Sleep on it?
I could, I say, but my answer would be the same.
Nettie rises to her feet, pushing her chair back hard enough to hit the wall behind it.
Nettie, I say, Nettie, I'm sorry.
Patrick puts a hand to his face, smoothing it across his forehead. I can't tell if it's a gesture of sadness or relief. I can tell what the expression on Nettie's face is, though, without a shadow of a doubt. Hatred.
Chapter 48. Diana.
The past.
Ending your own life, peacefully and painlessly. I type the words into the Google browser and hit enter. I can't remember the last time I used this damn computer, but it must have been a while ago because the mouse has run out of batteries. Now I have to use the damn pad on the computer and it's highly irritating. I finally managed to get the cursor to hover over the first link, Lifeline Australia, a suicide prevention organisation. It's not what I'm looking for, but I suppose it's quite prudent. There are probably all sorts of teens who want to end their lives over a relationship breakdown or a scandal over exposed nude photographs or something. Those kids don't know that their little crisis will pass and they will be far better off for the learning experience. One day they will speak to their own children about how once they thought their life wasn't worth living, but lo and behold, look at them now, a parent, a success, happy. Those people needed to find Lifeline and call the number. Not people like me. I am an old lady. I've lived a good life, been married, had my children. I need help to die, not help to live. I fiddle with the mouse pad again and refine my search. Voluntary euthanasia, Australia. Google tells me some things that I know, such as the fact that euthanasia is illegal in Australia, even though it happens routinely in hospitals for the terminally ill in their final days. Google also tells me things I don't know, such as the fact that it's incredibly difficult to purchase the drugs or equipment to euthanize yourself in a humane fashion. I don't qualify to go to Dignitas in Switzerland without being terminally ill, and the medical evidence they require is exhaustive and impossible to fake. Which leaves me, as far as I can see, with the internet. I've been taking the antidepressant medication that Dr. Paisley prescribed for nearly 6 months now, and I think it's been effective. My sleep has been better. I'm getting more enjoyment out of things. I'm managing to get dressed, feed myself, and do a bit of work. But Tom's still dead. There isn't a pill that will change that. I find a link to an organisation called Voluntary Euthanasia International, VEI. The print that pops up under the link says, VEI philosophy, that all adults of sound mind should have the right to end their life in a manner that is reliable, peaceful, and at a time of their choosing. VEI believes control over one's life and death to be a fundamental civil right from which no one of sound mind should be excluded. VEI mission, to inform members and support them in their end-of-life decision-making. I click on the link and keep reading.
Chapter 49. Lucy. The present. I drive myself to the police station. Ollie offered to come with me, but I told him not to be silly, someone had to stay with the kids. I didn't tell him the real reason I didn't want him to come, that I couldn't bear to see his face when he found out what I'd done.
I go to the desk to announce my arrival, but before I've even had a chance to say my name, Jones appears.
Lucy, come on up.
In the elevator, she apologizes for calling me this late, and I tell her it's fine, no problem, happy to help. But my voice sounds funny because I'm abuzz with nerves. Ollie must have been in this elevator not more than an hour before. Nettie and Patrick have been in here. Eamon too, apparently. A joke comes to mind. How many people does it take to kill a rich old lady? I only wish I knew. We shuffle down the hallway and into a different interview room that smells of cheap perfume and cigarettes. I take a seat, and so does Jones. Several beats pass, and she doesn't speak.
You had some questions? I ask finally.
We're just waiting for Ahmed.
Here I am, he says at precisely that moment, appearing in the doorway. It's a small room, and it feels even smaller with three of us in here. It makes me more nervous than I already was. The video recorder is in the corner, and they go through the spiel again, explaining that it is being recorded. Finally, we get down to business.
As I said on the phone, Jones says, the reason we called you in is we have become aware that your mother-in-law was a member of a group of proponents for voluntary euthanasia. This organisation holds meetings where they provide information on how a person can humanely end their own life.
I keep my facial expression carefully blank.
Oh? We have information that your mother-in-law attended one of these meetings and signed up to become a member.
She did?
Jones regards me head on. She did.
So you think she did kill herself?
We think she was thinking about it. It doesn't explain her death because she wasn't found with any poison in her system, but it is an interesting development.
I don't know what to say to this, and so I say nothing.
Can you tell me about your professional background, Lucy?
Jones says after nearly a minute's silence. I find a hangnail and pick at it. I'm a stay-at-home mother.
And before that?
I was a recruiter.
A recruiter?
Jones glances at Ahmed and doesn't try to conceal her smirk.
In which industry?
I hesitate. Information technology.
And your university degree was in IT and data analytics, is that correct?
It is.
So if someone asked you about how to encrypt email addresses, you'd know how to do it?
It's a question, ostensibly, but Jones makes it clear that it's actually a statement.
You could figure it out,
Jones suggests.
Probably, I admit. Do you know what bitcoins are?
Jones's questions are coming faster, and I wonder if it's a technique to discombobulate me. If so, it's working.
Yes, I think so. Why?
They stare at me, a knowing look in their eyes.
Am I under arrest? I ask, flustered. Because it's late, I really need to get home to my kids. Just one more question, Lucy, Jones says, and then you can go home. But I want you to think about this one before answering, okay? Really think about it.
Okay, I say.
Do you know that assisting someone to commit suicide is a crime in Australia? Punishable with up to 25 years in prison.
Chapter 50. Diana. The past. There are protesters out in front of the library, which I hadn't expected. They are not the silent type. They have placards and crucifixes and are chanting about God being the only one who could choose when a person can die. Clearly not, I think to myself, or they'd have nothing to protest about. I wish I'd brought a book along, then I could have held it up and they'd have left me alone. Just returning a book, I'd say. Instead, someone carrying a fluorescent yellow sign with the words, "Suicide is a cry for help, not a request to die," comes up to me with an offer to pray for my soul. A mother with a stroller and a couple of young Asian student types with laptops enter at the same time as me and are not approached.
It was relatively easy to book a ticket. The guidelines said you had to be over age 50 or seriously ill with documentation to prove it, and I quite plainly meet the first criterion. I'm not sure what I expected. Some sort of secret handshake in a dingy back room, perhaps? But the meeting is taking place in Toorak, of all places, one of, if not the, most affluent area of Melbourne. Leave it to the affluent to want to dictate the circumstances of their own death. The meeting is in a large room in the basement of the library. A man and a woman stand at the door, the woman holding a clipboard. The man, judging by his size and the fact that he appears to be serving no specific purpose, is a security guard. I haven't been to the Toorak Library before, but it seems unusually busy for a Thursday afternoon. I wonder if this meeting is responsible for the bustle. I approach the woman with the clipboard. My name is Diana Goodwin. I booked a ticket online. I produce my folded ticket, which I printed off that morning, and the woman checks it against her list. Online it said that attendees may be required to present identification, and I have mine ready. But after giving me a long look, she doesn't ask. Still, she is thorough. As she peers at me, I'm reminded of standing at immigration, being surveyed, questioned, required to be a convincing version of exactly who you are. Eventually, I pass the test, and I'm allowed in. The room is underwhelming. Mottled blue-grey carpet, black steel chairs with burgundy fabric seats arranged in rows, 20 rows at a guess, 6 and 6, with an aisle in between. There's an old-school whiteboard at the front with markers. I sit in the second row from the back, trying to make myself invisible. A few seats down from me, another woman, around my vintage, is clearly trying to do the same. In front of us sits a woman a good deal younger than 50, alongside an elderly wheelchair-bound man, her father perhaps. He is hooked up to a plethora of tubes that meet up at an oxygen tank that sits on the back of his chair like golf clubs on a buggy, and I can't help thinking of my dear Tom. The rest of the people in the room are in varying levels of health, 2 wearing oxygen masks, 3 suspiciously bald. A 70-ish man holds the hand of his wife, who is clearly suffering some sort of mental condition and is muttering constantly under her breath, and I hear her utter a few of the very worst curses. Only a couple of people sit boldly at the front. They look to be a husband and wife couple, silver-haired but straight-backed. Proud, paid-up members of VEI if ever I saw them. The man wears a shirt with his collar popped under a navy woolen sweater, and he sits back with his arms folded and an ankle balanced on the opposite foot. The woman wears a white blouse, a forest green sweater, and a string of pearls, and she is half turned around, talking to another woman, bizarrely, about herb gardens and the difficulty the other woman is having with her basil. The woman in green seems to know a lot about growing basil. I feel a pang of something looking at her, and I suspect it is to do with the proximity of her husband beside her. To the casual observer, he appears to be in fine health, but the casual eye doesn't see everything. Of this I am all too aware. After 5 or so minutes, the door closes, and the lady with the clipboard comes to the front of the room, leaving the large man stationed outside the door. I understand then that the woman is running the meeting. I knew the meeting would be led by a doctor. It might be sexist of me to have assumed it would be a man. If Tom had made the same assumption, I'd have given him hell for it.
Good afternoon, she says. Thank you all for being here. I see some familiar faces and I see some new ones. My name is Dr. Hannah Fisher.
Dr. Fisher is warm, bright and efficient and delivers a talk she is clearly familiar with. Indeed, she has dedicated her life's work to this talk and her belief in assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia. She talks generally about the history of voluntary euthanasia, the current legalities of what we can and cannot do, and preparing a last will and testament. She talks about the importance of being clear about your intentions.
If you are going to take your own life, she says, you need to be clear that this was your intention.
It is important to be as clear as possible to avoid any of your loved ones being held responsible and sent to jail. We recommend writing a letter making your intentions clear and leaving it in a prominent place. In the past, we have seen charges brought against family members. If you have a large estate, it might be worth donating it to charity to avoid your loved ones being seen to have a motivation to assist you with your death.
I think of my estate. There is no doubt it is large. I imagine Ollie's and Nettie's faces if they were to find out they'd been disinherited. It would be slightly less horrifying, I decide, than being found to have a possible motivation for my murder. We are given a handbook called The Serene End, which sets out specific approaches to euthanasia, including how to obtain the required materials through the internet.
How do I purchase the drug you have recommended? The Lituban?
The woman sitting next to maybe her father asks.
We're going to talk about it in a moment, Dr. Fisher says. And you'd better have your notepads ready. I can tell you of an effective way to end your life, but getting your hands on this drug is going to take some effort and commitment from you.
I sit forward, my notepad and pen ready. Finally, the information I came for. Chapter 51. Diana. The past.
Arash, put that down.
The little boy turns around, holding my blue and white vase in his sticky hands. Tom had purchased the vase in Paris many years ago. Even then it cost over 10,000 euros. A ridiculous amount of money, though I'd always been fond of the vase. Just leave him, Gazella, I say. It doesn't matter. I'm actually rather pleased to see Arash wandering around my house like he owns the place. His sister, Aziza, looks just as comfortable here. They remind me very much of my own grandchildren, burrowing under furniture and finding little crannies to hide in and fragile things to touch. And why not? What's it all for if not for children to play with? That's what Tom would have said anyway. How is Hakem? I ask.
Working hard, Gazella says. He's just employed two more people for his project, one of them from Afghanistan, one from Sudan.
That's wonderful. I try for a smile. I'm more comfortable with Gazella than many other people, but still, smiles don't come naturally these days.
We have many friends here from Afghanistan now. Hakem's sister and her husband are here.
That's wonderful, I say, and now a smile does come, a real one. Are they working?
They're looking, but they've been looking a while.
What kind of work did they do back home?
Different things. Some sales, some IT. Arash, put that down!
Arash is holding the vase again, peering into the hole at the top as if it's a telescope. But hearing his mother's voice, he sets it down hard on the floor. It doesn't break, but Gazella puts her hand to her heart and closes her eyes. Pick it up, I tell him. It's fine, play with it. I cannot find jobs for all of Gazella's friends, unfortunately. Even if Tom was alive, I couldn't. I can, however, let Arash and his sister play with my priceless vase. I can let them hold it or break it or use it as a telescope. And so I will let them. Where are your friends living? I ask.
In an apartment near us, she says. They know they are lucky. They're just not as lucky as us. Not everyone has someone like you, Diana, to take them under their wing.
We hear a sharp crack, and Gazella's hands form a tent over her mouth.
Arash! Oh, no!
We look over. The vase is broken into three large pieces on the parquetry flooring. The children stare at it, stunned and terrified. I just laugh and laugh. Chapter 52. Diana. The past.
I have something to tell you, I say to Lucy the week after my meeting at VEI. She is standing at my sink, hand-washing dishes. Edie is at her feet, playing with Tupperware containers and lids. I want to tell Lucy to leave the dishes, that I can do it myself, but I'm not sure I can. I feel bone-tired, weighed down, like I could lay my head on the kitchen counter and never lift it up again. Besides that, the fact is I'm enjoying being looked after. It doesn't come close to filling the gap that Tom left, but it fills it a little.
What is it? Lucy asks.
I saw Dr. Paisley last week. Lucy wipes her hair out of her face with a gloved hand.
I didn't know you had a doctor's appointment.
It was a follow-up appointment to get some test results. She gives me a funny look.
Test results for what?
Mammogram and ultrasound, my regular 2-yearly appointments.
Oh.
Lucy picks up a dish towel.
You should have told me, I would have driven you.
I'm not an invalid, I can drive myself. Lucy looks hurt.
I didn't say you were an invalid.
I'm sorry, I say quickly. That was rude. You've been a great help to me these past few months. Now she looks touched. How easily words can affect this one. It almost makes me regret what I'm about to say. I have breast cancer, Lucy. Quite advanced. She freezes, a plate in her hand. Dishwater drips from the fingertips down onto the floor.
Diana, no!
I haven't told the children yet. I will, of course. But I wanted to tell you first. Actually, I was hoping you could help me.
Of course I will help you. Lucy puts the plate down. I can be here when you tell them. I will help support them and you.
No, I interrupt. That's not what I meant. I search around for the words I'd planned, but they don't come to me. All of this is harder than I thought. I need help with something else. Lucy removes her gloves.
What do you need help with?
I need to buy some things online. But you see, I need an encrypted email address and bitcoins. I thought you might know how to get these. Lucy blinks. At first she is confused, but slowly I see it morph into suspicion.
Have you been taking your medication, Diana?
Yes.
And you're feeling better?
I shrug. Tom's still dead. No drug is going to change that. We drift into silence, apart from Edie playing happily on the floor. I watch as understanding comes to Lucy's face.
And now, she says slowly, you've discovered you're sick and you want to buy something online that requires an encrypted email address and bitcoins?
Yes. It's funny. For so long I've felt it's such a disconnect with her. And yet it's amazing what I've been able to communicate with her without saying a single word. If I tell you any more, Lucy, I will be exposing you to trouble, so please don't ask. I'm going to write a letter which will make my intentions clear. No one will ever know you were involved, not Ollie, not anyone. She closes her eyes.
Diana,
do this for me, Lucy. Please. You're the only one I can ask. It's the truth. Ollie and Nettie would never help me. I'm their mother, which means in our relationship they will always be children and will only see things from their own perspectives. They won't want me to die, and that will be the end of that. But Lucy sees me differently. Like a mother-in-law, yes, but also as a woman. Which means, for this, a daughter-in-law is perfect.
Chapter 53. Lucy. The present. I take the long way home from the police headquarters. As I drive, questions circle in my head.
Is this what you wanted, Diana? For me to go to jail? Was involving me all part of your elaborate plan?
Or did your plan go horribly wrong somewhere along the line?
My mind swirls with all the possibilities, and the worst part is that I can't ask her. I left the police station after claiming no knowledge. Now I am going to have to get in touch with a lawyer. Not Gerard, we can't afford him. Actually, we can't afford anyone. We're going to have to declare bankruptcy. We have no inheritance coming our way. I'll probably have to find someone from legal aid. I look at all the pieces of my life that have fallen apart in recent weeks. My husband's business has failed. My formerly pleasant relationship with my sister-in-law has soured. And my mother-in-law is dead. The funny thing is, until recently, news of my mother-in-law's death wouldn't have been devastating, beyond the obvious feelings of sympathy for my husband and children. But now, the loss cuts surprisingly deep. It's quiet when I let myself into the house. Then I hear Ollie. "Lucy?" he whispers. I drop the keys into the bowl and follow his voice to the bedroom. The side lamp is on, and Ollie is sitting on the edge of his bed in his boxer shorts, his elbows on his knees, his head in his hands. He glances up when I enter. "Are you okay?" I ask.
"Not really," he says. "I want to explain why I was at Mum's the day she died."
Why I was at Mum's the day she died. It takes me a minute to understand what he is talking about, but then I remember. Before I went to the police station, Ollie had admitted he was at Diana's house the day she died. That conversation seems like a million years ago.
"Okay."
I sit beside him on the bed and flick on the bedside lamp.
"Explain."
"I dropped in for a visit," he says. "I wanted to tell her about my business troubles."
"But why didn't you tell me that?" I ask, frustrated. "I've known for a week about your business troubles."
Ollie looks down, and suddenly I'm afraid of his answer. I don't think Ollie is capable of hurting his mother, but obviously something happened during that meeting. Something he didn't want me to know. I don't think I can take another shock, another betrayal. But judging by the look of determination in Ollie's face, it looks like I'm not going to have a choice.
"Because a long time ago," he says, dropping his head into his hands, "you made me promise I'd never ask Mum for money again."
Chapter 54. Diana. The past. I meet Nettie at a cafe, at her suggestion. Nettie and I don't usually meet at cafes, but nothing is normal lately. I'd told the children that I had breast cancer a couple of weeks earlier. Ollie had gone through the motions of shock and sadness, which I expected. Nettie's reaction was less expected. I'd thought she'd have a controlled but concerned reaction, asking for information, statistics, names of doctors. But she hadn't asked a single question. Her mind had been elsewhere, even then. Since Tom died, I'd noticed her behaviour had become increasingly odd. Every so often she'd come to the house, but rather than speaking to me, she'd just wander about searching for Tom in the folds of the curtains and the creases of the sofa. She never said that was what she was doing, but I knew because I did it too. Once, just a few weeks after Tom's death, I came home and found her curled up on his side of the bed. I left her there and snuck away, and she never knew that I saw her. Sometimes we need to grieve together, and sometimes we need to grieve alone. As I approach the cafe, I notice a playground across the road full of mothers bundled in puffer jackets pushing babies in strollers or shouting up at older kids who have climbed to the top of a climbing frame to come down for morning tea. I am wondering if I should find us a table inside, away from it all. After all, why make it worse for Nettie? When I see her sitting at a table out in front.
"Mum!"
I nearly don't recognize her. She's thinner than she's ever been, and her skin is sallow and pale, and yet at the same time she looks slightly more alive than the last time I saw her. The idea flickers through my mind that she might be pregnant.
I can't decide if that would be good news or not.
Hello, darling.
I kiss her cheek and sit opposite her on a cold metal chair. There are mushroom heaters dotted about and woolen blankets on the backs of the chairs, but it doesn't replace the shelter of four walls, in my opinion.
Isn't it a little cold out here?
I'm fine. Nettie smiles.
Nettie comes across, I'm assured from most people I meet, as a happy, cheery person who never has a bad word to say about anyone. And she is indeed smiley, at least she used to be. But there are some things only a mother can tell. This smile, for instance, is not indicative of happiness. It is a smile of strategy, a smile of digging her heels in. It's a smile that says, we're sitting outside. If you don't want to, you're going to have to be the one to rock the boat.
Every one of Nettie's smiles means something.
If you're fine, I say with a smile of my own, we'll stay. It occurs to me that I should be taking every opportunity to be outside. I should be breathing in fresh air, walking in the mountains and working my way through my bucket list. But my bucket list is fairly short, fairly uninspiring. In fact, the only thing on my bucket list is to spend time with my family and to make sure they are going to be okay after I leave them behind.
The website you need for the email address is here,
Lucy had said a couple of weeks earlier, thrusting a piece of paper at me. She'd arrived at my house unannounced again and started talking double time as if she'd chicken out if she didn't.
Regarding bitcoins, the first thing you need to do is get a bitcoin wallet. There's an app you can download to your phone. Then you need to buy some bitcoins. You should be able to do this directly from the app.
I stared at her. She might as well have been speaking Chinese. She'd watched me for a second or two, then sighed and reached for my phone. Now I have two bottles of the drug, the Lituban, in my fridge door, ready to drink. It is tasteless, apparently, and should be drunk alone, though you could follow it with a glass of wine if you wished. I've written the letter. I need to see Gerard about the will. I'll leave every cent to the charity to ensure that none of my family can be seen to benefit from my death. I'll let the children know what I'd done. And then I'd go and see Tom, wherever he was. The waitress arrives and Nettie and I both order tea.
How are you?
I ask Nettie when the waitress is gone.
I'm good,
she says, and then there's a few beats of silence.
I mean, I'm not pregnant, if that's what you're asking.
I did wonder. I'm sorry, darling.
Yes, well, it's what I wanted to talk to you about. At the last IVF appointment, Dr. Sheldon said there were two problems, my eggs and my uterus. She said my best chance would be to use a donor egg and a surrogate. I know what you're thinking,
she says after a moment or two. Really? I don't even know what I'm thinking. The waitress returns with our drinks and places them on the table. I pick up my mug and lift it to my mouth.
Listen, I get it, Nettie says. It took me a while to process it too. I mean, it wouldn't be biologically my child. I wouldn't carry it in my body. At first I wasn't really on board. Then I started thinking, it would be a child created by us, for us. I would be able to be part of the pregnancy. I would be there at the birth. I would still be a mother. And Mum, that is the most important thing to me.
What about adoption? I ask, and Nettie's face falls. I realize that this had been the part where I was supposed to get swept up in excitement.
Do you know how many adoptions took place in Victoria last year?
She says.
Six. Six, four of which were interfamily. Adopting is nearly impossible in Australia.
And surrogacy, that's possible in Australia?
There is altruistic surrogacy in Australia, where a friend or family member offers to do it. I asked Lucy if she'd do it, but she wasn't open to the idea.
Nettie is speaking quickly, almost maniacally. Her hands, I notice, are shaking.
And it's illegal to be a surrogate for financial gain. The most common way, and the route our doctor suggested, was to source a donor egg from India and pay a surrogate in the USA. The thing is, it's not cheap. The process, including the eggs, the insemination, the surrogate's medical expenses and fees, It will all come to well over 100,000.
She finally pauses, takes a breath.
$100,000?
I stare at her. Can you afford that? Nettie holds my gaze.
No, but you can.
I put my tea back in its saucer. Suddenly I understand the purpose of the visit. I feel a little foolish that it's taken me this long.
You wouldn't even miss the money,
she says, already countering my yet-to-vocalize arguments.
And it would be a grandchild.
But what if it didn't work? What if we found a surrogate and you implanted an embryo and it didn't take? What then?
We'd try again.
How many times, Nettie? At $100,000 per go? She shrugs as if it's a minor detail, something that can be ironed out later.
As many as it takes, I guess.
How had I not seen this? I knew she was desperate to have a baby. I'd suspected she might have even been depressed over it. But today I wonder if it's more than that. If it's the beginning, or middle, of a descent into madness.
So what you're really asking me for, I say carefully, is access to unlimited funds.
This is my last chance. I need you, Mum.
All at once I'm back at Orchard House, sitting opposite my mother, begging. Begging for my baby. I close my eyes, take a breath. I'll think about it, okay? Chapter 55. Diana. The past. I'm standing in the dining room sorting through donations of baby clothes when I hear the distinct sound of footsteps on the parquetry floor. I go very still. The footsteps are heavier than Nettie's, less precise and careful. It is in moments like these that I see my vulnerability, an elderly-ish woman alone in a huge cavernous house. I creep a few steps toward the double doors and catch a glimpse of a huge lumbering shadow. Oh, I find my heart. Patrick.
Sorry to sneak up on you, he says. The door was unlocked.
Patrick doesn't often drop by for a visit. In fact, I'm not sure he ever has without Nettie.
I need to talk to you about Nettie, he says.
He pulls out the chair closest to me and sits. I remain standing.
What's wrong with Nettie? I ask.
Patrick raises an eyebrow.
Are you seriously asking what is wrong with Nettie?
As I recover from my surprise, irritation kicks in. Patrick has a nerve coming here, speaking to me like this when everyone in the world knows he's messing around on my daughter.
This is about the surrogacy?
I upend a new bag of baby clothes onto the table.
What else?
Absently, Patrick picks up a tiny knitted jacket.
I'm assuming Nettie has her wires crossed because she says you're thinking about paying for it.
I frown.
And you've come to plead your case?
Actually, I've come to plead the opposite.
This catches me off guard.
You're coming to me because you don't want money?
I admit I'm lost. In the many visits I've had from my children and their spouses, never has anyone asked me not to give money.
Nettie would kill me if she knew I was here, obviously.
Patrick looks out the window onto the garden. She's on a mission for a baby. She's obsessed by it.
You think I don't know that?
You don't know anything.
He raises his voice, cutting through any pretense of decorum between us.
It's like she's possessed. Some days I'll be talking to her and it's like she's not even there. Her legs and stomach are covered in bruises from injecting herself with hormones. She spends her entire life on the internet reading stories from people who managed to conceive after years of trying. She trawls through forums of people who have done IUI or IVF or lately surrogacy. She doesn't talk about anything else. Nothing else.
He tosses the little jacket back onto the table. For a moment, I'm taken aback. Only a moment. That must be awful for you, I say quietly. No wonder you had to find multiple girlfriends to ease your burden. Patrick stares at me. You'll need to go a little farther away than country Victoria if you want to keep a secret around these parts, Patrick. Patrick has the decency to look ashamed, which is something, I suppose. I study him. So, you don't want a baby, is that it? You don't want to be shackled to Nettie? No, that's not it. I do want a baby. At least I did. But I accepted it wasn't going to happen a few years back. Nettie didn't. And now I don't know how to help her. She's either a walking zombie or she's totally manic from her latest fertility idea. She's not the same person I married. He looks so sad I rein in my anger. So what do you want from me, Patrick? I don't want anything. That's exactly my point. Actually, you do want something. You want me to withhold money from my daughter so you can avoid having a conversation with her that you need to have. Patrick opens his mouth, but I get in first. And what happens next? Once Nettie gives up on her baby dream, you give up your girlfriends and you all live happily ever after? He exhales. I don't know, okay? But he does know, and suddenly I do too. There are age restrictions around surrogacy in Australia, even for intended parents. In a few years, Nettie and Patrick will be too old to become parents, which means Patrick just has to ride out Nettie's craziness for another year or two. And with my recent cancer diagnosis, in 2 or 3 years he'll be able to enjoy a comfortable, childless life. A life with all the little extras he's enjoyed with us over the years. Whiskey, cigars, homes by the beach. Now that it's within his reach, he's not going to give it up. Well, I say, regardless of whether I give Nettie this money for surrogacy, you need to talk to her. You need to tell her about the other women, and you need to tell her you no longer want a baby. Patrick shakes his head. This has not gone the way he wanted. He thought he could come here and form some alliance with me, I realize. Him and me against my daughter. The idea makes me sick to my stomach. Diana, I really don't think... If you don't, Patrick, I will. Patrick's eyes flash as he rises to his feet. He smiles, a horrible, mean smile. Look at you, acting all concerned about your daughter. Nettie spent her whole life vying for your attention and you'd never given her the time of day. You've spent more time worrying about your refugee women than your own children, and now you're acting holier than thou. Who do you think you are? I think I'm her mother. Some mother? He squares up against me, but I'm not scared. If Patrick wants me to change my mind, he's going to have to kill me. Chapter 56. Diana. The Past. After his pathetic attempt of trying to intimidate me, Patrick finally leaves. I finish sorting the baby clothes and then go into the study. I sit in Tom's old study chair, running my fingers over the surface of the desk, picking up pens and notepads, touching the things that he touched. It's been a year since he died, and he's started to disappear from other rooms, which have been cleaned numerous times. But I still feel him in here. I remember that conversation we had a few years back about the kids and money. It's about support, Tom had said, whether to give it or not. Patrick doesn't want me to give them money for the surrogacy. Nettie does. One way or another, Nettie has a rough time ahead of her, and she'll need someone to support her. I hear a key in the door, and a moment later, Diana, are you home? It's Lucy's voice. I sit up straight. Lucy hasn't been here since the night she came to encrypt my email address and show me how to use bitcoins. I didn't know if I would see her again after that. But here she is rounding the corner, dressed in jeans and a white t-shirt and hot pink ballet flats and a zebra scarf around her neck. Still fashionable,
but a little more subtle these days. It's as though she's maturing, coming into herself, figuring out who she really is. "I'm sorry I haven't been by," she says.
"Don't apologize, I understand."
"I do understand. It's a tall order visiting someone after you have helped them to procure drugs illegally to end their life. What would we talk about? The future was off limits, obviously, as were plans for Christmas or upcoming holidays. There was simply nothing left to discuss. Still, I can't deny the fact that I feel happy to see Lucy. Over the past few months, I've become accustomed to having her around, making food or doing the dishes or booking my appointments. It had made it feel all the more quiet when she wasn't here. I'd been surprised, even humbled, by her devotion. Perhaps the biggest surprise was that, while I know she doesn't want me to take my own life, she's never, not once, tried to talk me out of it. It reminds me of the way she supports Ollie. Suddenly I see it for what it is. A gift.
"What are you doing here in the study?" she asks.
I look around the room. It feels empty, even filled with furniture. "Looking for Tom," I admit with a smile. A soft smile crosses her face.
"It's lovely, the way you love him."
"Funny, I was just thinking the same about the way you love Ollie." "The thing about death is that it puts things into perspective. I know what I care about now. I care about my children and my grandchildren. I care about my charity continuing to operate. I care about people getting a fair go. And I care about Lucy." Lucy presses her lips together, swallows.
You've never said that to me before."
"No, but I should have. I'm sorry I didn't." She crosses the room and